I must admit, this part struck me as slightly unlikely, so I googled and turned up with the interesting word biophoton, which you may find worth a look. Now, I should be particularly interested to hear what you, the audience, have to make of biophotons. So if you have thoughts, you could email me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net.
Newtonian physics says, when photons strike a surface, they bounce off, and the photon is fundamentally unchanged. You see, it's the billiard ball view again. Actually, that's not what happens. What happens is, when a photon strikes a surface, it's absorbed by the surface, and it also almost it disappears into the quantum void. And then a new photon is reconstituted and emitted by the surface. So that's what happens with reflection. So imagine that a photon is striking a green tree. Lots of photons are striking the tree. Then the photons are going deeply inside the tree, maybe beyond the tree, into this quantum realm, where perhaps they absorb the very essence of treeness itself. And then this essence of treeness now saturates the new photons that are emitted. The new photons are actually tree photons, and they're vibrating treely, if you see what I mean. They then go into your retinas, where they transfer that treely information, or that tree sensibility, into your whole organism, and so you become tree yourself. So in this sense, light could be a form of communication, deep communication, like glue almost, that glues us to the world, and is a channel for meaning between different beings in the world.
Deep ecology is a philosophy of nature that is looking at the psychological or spiritual dimension underlying the environmental crisis. The term was coined by Arne Næss, the late Arne Næss, who was professor of philosophy at Oslo University, and he saw that the fundamental level of the environmental crisis is the illusion of separation between human beings and the rest of the natural world, and that this stems from anthropocentrism, or human-centeredness, the idea that human beings are the center of everything. We are the crown of creation, the measure of all being, and the world consists of human beings on the one hand and resources for human beings on the other hand. So it's seen as some kind of a pyramid with human beings on the top. Whereas Indigenous people and the science of ecology recognise that a better metaphor is a web with human beings, just one strand in that web, nothing special, and as we destroy the other strands, we destroy ourselves.
The Earth as a whole is a great system. Now, what do we mean by a system? It means that it's pretty obvious, really, that everything is interconnected. That the land, the oceans, the rocks, the atmosphere, and the living creatures are all connected in one great system. So that anything that happens to any part of the system will ramify through the whole and can shift it to new states. But before Lovelock, the idea was that the living beings couldn't possibly affect water terribly much, or the rocks, or the atmosphere. They had to adapt to these things, but they couldn't really influence them very much. But Lovelock showed how, in fact, living beings do influence the atmosphere, rocks and water. For example, without any life, you can show that there would be no water now on the planet, because living beings, particularly bacteria, are able to keep water around on the planet. This demonstrates what Lynn Margulis has said, I think, several times, that it's the microbes that rule the world.
The forms of life that are critical to the system are all microbes. And so the Earth can go through vast fluctuations and dispense with all this fluff experiment in evolution in higher life, including humanity, and not really miss much of a beat.
Gaia is a very interesting name. The goddess Gaia was actually parthenogenic. There's no male or female. It was a reproduction by parthenogenesis, and still exists in some species today. And I was very interested that Lovelock used that, because the end result of that, in terms of evolution, is destruction.
If we were to look for a reason in all of this, you know, I mean, apart from the fact that the universe itself is a very violent place as well as being a very loving place, and that whole galaxies explode out of existence and volcanoes and tsunamis and all of this is part and parcel of it, the interesting thing is that evolution takes place in spurts and bursts of creativity, and these spectacularly follow extinction spasms.
In a very real sense, the Earth has two completely different personalities. One temperament seems calm and benign, well in control of the forces locked within the Earth or playing around its biosphere. The other is a hard, hostile, often deadly nature, a nature racked and tormented by these same forces rampaging out of control.
There have been tremendous disturbances from within, created from within the system itself, by the system itself, huge reorganizations, sometimes from, caused by internal factors, sometimes by external factors. And the regulation hasn't been perfect either. You know, it's wobbled around, sometimes dangerously hot, sometimes dangerously cold. Just, it's like a, almost like a semi-drunken guy walking on a tightrope, sometimes almost falling off into heating and recovering a bit and then almost falling off into cooling. And she's managed to keep this going for 3,500,000 million years. And of course you could think of us as the latest disturbance to her self-regulatory dance.
There was a great thing that James Lovelock once said when he spoke about, you know, a rather deep ecology perspective, I think, where he said that what we're doing, what humans are doing, is as if the brain were to decide it was the most important organ in the body and started mining the liver.
Whether persons belong to a primitive tribe or to a complex civilization, they know fairly well what life has in store for them, because their culture has marked the way. These cultures are vastly different from each other. The kind of land in which the culture exists plays an important part in shaping its pattern. Biological characteristics may account for some of the differences between cultures. But the main reason why there are so many different kinds of culture among the people of the Earth are the differences in their historical experiences. Despite these differences, there are many universal problems faced by all people, which their different cultures solve in their own ways.
Having grown up myself in social movements, I now have to ask myself, did I perpetuate the nuclear movement by being in the anti-nuclear movement? And yes, you do. You do. Because wherever you've got the subject, you've got the object. But what also you have to realise is that the subject, in fact, creates the object. We live in this duality. We can't get away from this duality. It's the nature of our existence. How we mediate this duality is very important. If you know anything about game theory, I firmly believe that the military and the governments operate on the principle of game theory. And game theory, of course, is that you make the undesirable the desirable. And in order to do that, then you have to pose the two sides and make what is bad good in the minds of the people. And I think this is what happens. And yes, it does confuse things. And this is postmodernism. We see it everywhere now. We see it in, for example, things like sustainable festivals across the world that are happening. Yes, you have all these wonderful green products being sold there and these green ideas, but you'll find the coal industry there as well. And you've got the polluting companies are actually the biggest advocates for the environment, you know. And you have to say, well, why? What is lying behind that?
If Gandhi pulled out the spinning wheel to fight the first industrial revolution and all its associated colonizations, then what is today's spinning wheel? Today's spinning wheel is the seed. We get it for free from nature. We have evolved it through our collective intelligence. We need it for our survival, and we are not going to obey intellectual property laws that reduce it to being the monopoly property of corporations.
Although one can see maybe the past logic of allegiance to a nation state that provided you with security, there's now ample evidence to show that there is no security in that nation state, and that we have to disengage from that. In a way, it's the old principles of pacifist non-participation. But the important thing is, it's got to be a much more activist building the parallel world. And I think there's hope in what happened to some extent in the decline of Rome, that we can see as Rome went through its various horrendous crises and sort of various systems fell apart, that actually as the empire unraveled, conditions for ordinary people actually got better, because they weren't any longer having to support the huge taxation burden to maintain the extended armies and all of the infrastructure. And there's ample evidence to show that to some extent life actually improved.
And from my perspective, as an author, philosopher, lecturer, we are also in a battle to determine what will survive mankind's history, that will be carried over after the collapse, where we will have a very painful transition phase and era that will be bloody, messy, but eventually the dust will settle. The question is, what will survive? The choice being presented to mankind now is either evolve or perish, grow up or die. Change the way you view the world and your relationship to it, because I believe this planet is alive, and I believe that we have to establish a basic fundamental connection with all life on this planet to achieve something called balance, or steady state, whatever you want to call it, sustainable, that doesn't pretend or aspire to overturn the physical laws of the universe or to make man a god, but to make man hopefully an intelligent creation living in harmony in God's universe.
Do we wish to continue the way that we're living, regardless of whether the planet is heating up or not? Do we want to inherit an Earth that looks like this? Splitting hairs over the degree of temperature rise on the planet is in fact a red herring to the obvious and rampant environmental destruction that's taking place. And we're fools if we think that this destruction will not eventually impact on us.
And there's another point to be made about all of this. If you try to think through the cost-benefit analysis, suppose the people who deny it are correct and you do something about it. Okay, you've spent some money doing things you probably should have done anyway, you know, like more renewable energy and so on. But the total cost is it cost you something. Suppose, on the other hand, that the consensus is right. Well, if you don't do anything, human species is probably down the drain. Okay, those are the costs you have to estimate. That's not particularly subtle.
The most important thing now is not what scientists think about animism. It's getting the sense that we're inside a great living creature out into the general public, that it's okay to feel what you feel in the forest, that what you feel, what you intuit in the forest or out in nature or by the sea, that all of that is a genuine form of communication from the Earth, that the Earth is actually speaking to you. That's the most important thing for us to learn now as a culture. It's very important for the scientists to do their science, and I wish they would do it in a more animistic spirit. But it doesn't matter if they don't take it on board. It's more important for the general public to take this on board. If we're business people, we can think of it like this. We're working for Gaia Inc. This is the boss, you know. The whole Earth system is the boss. Or another way I put it is that we can be Gaia'd. In other words, that the Earth herself is an active agency, almost a psychological agency, a psyche, that can sweep away the illusion of separation that we have and give us this gift of connectedness with her great vast body. We can use our science, the science of Gaia, or Earth system science if you like, to really develop a sense of deep belonging to the Earth. Because the stories that science has given us, like the ones I've outlined, are so miraculous and inspiring that we can use them to help us fall in love with the Earth.
Of course, looking around at the world, you couldn't say that it's not like this is a point of view that's sweeping the world or anything like that. But, maybe if you make a good enough film, who knows?
Or maybe a good enough radio show? Well, I'm going to suggest that perhaps the idea of growing your own food is actually sweeping the world right now, sped by internet technology, as people realise it's not that hard to grow your own food. It's got an intrinsic logic, which is simple and appeals to pretty much all of humanity. Fresh, organic produce makes for a much better life than stuff out of the supermarket. And if you'd like to look up people doing this on the internet, you might want to look at Incredible Edible Todmorden. And now we're going to hear from Wendell Berry on the ecological crisis as a crisis of culture, something that cannot be changed independently of how people treat the world around them.
This is Chapter 3 of The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture by Wendell Berry. One reason that an organization cannot properly enact our relationship to the world is that an organization cannot define that relationship except in general terms. And no matter how general may be a person's attitude toward the world, his impact upon it must become specific and tangible at some point. Sooner or later, in his behalf, whether he approves or understands or not, the strip miner's bulldozer tears into a mountainside. The stand of trees is clear cut. A gully washes through a cornfield. The conservation movement has never resolved this dilemma. It has never faced it. Until very recently, until pollution and strip mining became critical issues, conservationists divided the country into that land which they wish to preserve and enjoy, the wilderness areas, and that which they consign to use by other people. With the increase of pollution and mining, their interest has become too branched to include, along with the pristine, the critically abused. At present, the issue of use is still in its beginning. Because of this, the mentality of conservation is divided, and disaster is implicit in its division. It is divided between the intentional protection of some places and some aspects of the environment, and its inadvertent destruction of others. It is variously either vacation-oriented or crisis-oriented. For the most part, it is not yet sensitive to the impact of daily living upon the sources of daily life. The typical present-day conservationist will fight to preserve what he enjoys. He will fight whatever directly threatens his health. He will oppose any ecological violence large or dramatic enough to attract his attention. But he is not yet worried much about the impact of his own livelihood, habits, pleasures, or appetites. He has not, in short, addressed himself to the problem of use. He does not have a definition of his relationship to the world that is sufficiently elaborate and exact. The problem is well defined in a letter I received from David Budville of Wolcott, Vermont. What I've noticed around here with the militant ecology people, don't get me wrong, I, like you, consider myself one of them, is a syndrome I call the terrarium view of the world. Nature always at a distance, under glass. Downcountry people come up here, buy a 30-acre meadow, and then when you ask them what they plan to do with it, they look at you like you're some kind of war criminal and say, "Why, nothing. We want to leave it just the way it is." They think they're protecting the environment even though they've forgotten or never knew what that nature abhors a vacuum. And in a couple of years, their meadow is full of hardhacken berries and young gray birch and red maple. Pretty soon they can't even walk through the brush, it's so thick. They treat the land like any other possession, object they own. Set it aside, watch it, passively, not wanting to, nay, thinking it abhorrent, to engage in a living relationship with it. Another thing folks like this do is buy land and immediately post it to protect the animals, or their investment, I guess. Then go back home. The old guy or the young guy who has always hunted deer on that piece is mad. The excuse for posting protection is a thinly disguised cover for the real notion, which has to do with the possessive capitalist ideas about property. I'm not opposed to private property, like it even, but the folks I'm talking about in their posting violate a strong local tradition of free trespass. There are disadvantages to free trespass. Abuses, we've suffered them, but what's good about it is it understands something about use and sharing. The upper-class eco-folks lack this understanding. We always, with our neighbor, pick apples in the fall off trees on a down-country owner's land. There's a feeling we have the right to do that, a feeling that the sin is not trespass, the sin is letting the apples go to waste. What I'm trying to get at is that in the environmental movement, there's some ugly, elitist, class-struggle-type things operating. Best example of this around here is the controversy over trailers. The Audubon types, I'm a member of Audubon, are fighting terribly hard to zone trailers out of areas like this. Put them in trailer parks or eliminate them altogether. Well, a trailer is the only living space a working man around here can afford. And if he, say, inherits 3 acres from a parent and wants to put a trailer on it, the eco-folks would like to say no, which is a dandy way to ghettoize the poor. There's so many elements of class struggle lying under the attitudes of a lot of environmentalists. It's scary. Their view of the natural world is so delicate and precious, terrarium-like, picture windowish. I know nature is precious and delicate. I also know it is incredibly tough and resilient, has unbelievable power to respond to and flourish with kindly use. I don't care about the landscape if I am to be excluded from it. Why should I? In Audubon magazine, almost always the beautiful pictures are without man, the ugly ones with him. Such self-hatred. I keep wanting to write to them and say, look, my name is David Budbill, and I belong to the chain of being too. As a participant, not an observer, nature is not television. And the question isn't to use or not to use, but rather how to use. The conservationist congratulates himself, on the one hand, for his awareness of the severity of human influence on the natural world. On the other hand, in his own contact with that world, he can think of nothing but to efface himself, to leave it just the way it is. This is an important issue, and I want to be careful not to oversimplify it. What has to be acknowledged at the outset is that wilderness conservation is important, and that it has its place in any conservation program, just as the wilderness has its place in human memory and culture. It seems likely to me that the concern for wilderness must stand at the apex of the conservation effort, just as it probably must stand at the apex of consciousness in any decent culture. There are several reasons for this. One, our biological roots, as well as our cultural roots, are in nature. We began in a world that was pristine, undiminished by anything we had done, and at various times in our history, the unspoiled wilderness has again imposed itself, its charming and forbidding invitation upon our consciousness. It is important that we should preserve this memory. We need places in reach of every community where children can imagine the prehistoric in the beginning of history, the unknown, the trackless, the first comers. 2. If we are properly humble in our use of the world, we need places that we do not use at all. We need the experience of leaving something alone, We need places that we forbear to change, or influence by our presence, or impose on, even by our understanding. Places that we accept as influences upon us, not the other way around. That we enter with the sense, the pleasure, of having nothing to do there. Places that we must enter in a kind of cultural nakedness, without comforts or tools, to submit rather than to conquer. We need what other ages would have called sacred groves. We need groves anyhow, that we would treat as if they were sacred, in order, perhaps, to perceive their sanctity. 3. We need wilderness as a standard of civilization and as a cultural model. Only by preserving areas where nature's processes are undisturbed can we preserve an accurate sense of the impact of civilization upon its natural sources. Only if we know how the land was can we tell how it is. Records, figures, statistics will not suffice. To know, in the true sense, is to see. We must see the difference in rates of erosion, for instance, or in the soil structure or fertility, in order to keep it as small as possible. As a cultural model, the wilderness is probably indispensable. Sir Albert Howard suggests that it is when he says that farmers should pattern the maintenance of their fields after the forest floor, for the forces of growth and the forces of decay are in balance there. But we cannot hope, for reasons practical and humane, we cannot even wish to preserve more than a small portion of the land in wilderness. Most of it we will have to use. The conservation mentality swings from self-righteous outrage to self-deprecation because it has neglected this issue. Its self-contradictions can only be reconciled, and the conservation impulse made to function as ubiquitously and variously as it needs to, by understanding, imagining, and living out the possibility of kindly use. Only that can dissolve the boundaries that divide people from the land and its care, which together are the source of human life. There are many kinds of land use, but the one that is most widespread and in need of consideration is that of agriculture. For us, the possibility of kindly use is weighted with problems. In the first place, this is not ultimately an organizational or institutional solution. Institutional solutions tend to narrow and simplify as they approach action. A large number of people can act together only by defining the point or the line on which their various interests converge. Organizations tend to move towards single objectives, a ruling, a vote, a law, and they find it relatively simple to cohere under acronyms and slogans. But kindly use is a concept that of necessity broadens, becoming more complex and diverse as it approaches action. The land is too various in its kinds, climates, conditions, declivities, aspects, and histories to conform to any generalized understanding or to prosper under generalized treatment. The use of land cannot be both general and kindly, just as the forms of good manners, generally applied, that is, without consideration of difference, are experienced as indifference, bad manners. To treat every field or every part of every field with the same consideration is not farming but industry. Kindly use depends upon intimate knowledge, the most sensitive responsiveness and responsibility. As knowledge, hence use, is generalized, essential values are destroyed. As the householder evolves into a consumer, the farm evolves into a factory, with results that are potentially calamitous for both. The understanding of kindly use in agriculture must encompass both farm and household, for the mutuality of influence between them is profound. Once, of course, the idea of a farm included the idea of a household. An integral and major part of a farm's economy was the economy of its own household. The family that owned and worked the farm lived from it. But the farm also helped to feed other households in towns and cities. These households were dependent on the farms, but not passively so, for their dependence was limited in two ways. For one thing, The town or city household was itself often a producer of food. One time, town and city lots routinely included garden space and often included pens and buildings to accommodate milk cows, fattening hogs, and flocks of poultry. For another thing, the urban household carefully selected and prepared the food that it bought. The neighborhood shops were suppliers of kitchen raw materials to local households, of whose needs and tastes the shopkeepers had personal knowledge. The shopkeepers were under the direct influence and discipline of their customers' wants, which they had to supply honestly if they hoped to prosper. The household was therefore not merely a unit in the economy of food production. Its members practice essential productive skills. The consumers of food were also producers or processors of food, or both. This collaboration of household and farm was never, in America, sufficiently thrifty or sufficiently careful of soil fertility. It is tempting to suppose that, given certain critical historical and cultural differences, they might have developed sufficient thrift and care. As it happened, however, the development went in the opposite direction. The collaborators purified their roles. The household became simply a house, a residence, purely consumptive in its function. The farm ceased to be a place to live and a way of life and became a unit of production, and their once collaborative relationship became competitive. Between them, the merchant, who had only been a supplier of raw materials, began to usurp the previous functions of both household and farm, becoming increasingly both a processor and producer. And so an enterprise that once had some susceptibility to qualitative standards, standards of personal taste and preference at one end and of good husbandry at the other, has come more and more under the influence of standards that are merely economic or quantitative. The consumer wants food to be as cheap as possible. The producer wants it to be as expensive as possible. Both want it to involve as little labor as possible. And so the standards of cheapness and convenience, which are irresistibly simplifying and therefore inevitably exploitive, have been substituted for the standard of health of both people and land, which would enforce consideration of essential complexities. Social fashion, delusion, and propaganda have combined to persuade the public that our agriculture is, for the best of reasons, the envy of the modern world. American citizens are now ready to believe without question that it is entirely good, a grand accomplishment, that each American farmer now feeds himself and 56 others. They're willing to hear that 96% of America's manpower is freed from food production without asking what it may have been freed for, or how many, as a consequence, have been freed from employment of any kind. The climate of opinion is now such that a recent assistant Secretary of Agriculture could condemn the principle of crop rotation without even an acknowledgement of the probable costs in soil depletion and erosion. And former Secretary of Agriculture Butts could say with approval that in 1974, only 4% of all U.S. farms produced almost 50% of all farm goods, without acknowledging the human and indeed the agricultural penalties. What these men were praising, what such men have been praising for so long that the praise can be uttered without thought, is a disaster that is both agricultural and cultural. The generalization of the relationship between people and land. That one American farmer can now feed himself and 56 other people may be, within the narrow view of the specialist, a triumph of economics and technology. By no stretch of reason can it be considered a triumph of agriculture or of culture. It has been made possible by the substitution of energy for knowledge, of methodology for care, of technology for morality. This accomplishment is not primarily the work of farmers, who have been, and by and large, its victims, but of a collaboration of corporations, university specialists, and government agencies. It is therefore an agricultural development, not motivated by agricultural aims or disciplines, but by the ambitions of merchants, industrialists, bureaucrats, and academic careerists. We should not be surprised to find that its effect on both the farmland and the farm people has been ruinous. It has divided all land into two kinds, that which permits the use of large equipment and that which does not. And it has divided all farmers into two kinds, those who have sufficient business sense and managerial ability to handle the large acreages necessary to finance large machines, and those who do not. The lands that are too steep or stony or small-featured to be farmed with big equipment are increasingly not farmed at all, but are abandoned to weeds and bushes, often with the gullies of previous bad use unrepaired. That these lands can often be made highly productive with kindly use is simply of no interest. We now have neither the small technology nor the small economics nor the available workforce necessary to make use of them. What might be the importance of these marginal lands and of an agricultural technology and economy appropriate to them, in light of population growth, is a question that the agriculture experts apparently would be embarrassed to consider, so entranced are they by the glamour of bigness. As for the farm families, who cannot get bigger and therefore have to get out, they are apparently written off as a reasonable, quite ordinary, and altogether bearable expense. Former Secretary Butts could praise the business acumen of the new big-time American farmer. In all likelihood, he knows as much about financing and business accountability as his banker. Evidently, without wondering what may be the agricultural import or effect of such knowledge, or if somewhere there might not be an excellent farmer who is not more acute in a business way than his banker. But this is the catch. In our almost religious dependence on experts, Mr. Butts is a farm expert, and a farm expert is by definition not a farmer. He has changed sides. I have at hand 15 speeches by Mr. Butts and his assistant secretaries, all of which praise the productivity, that is, the business success, of the American farmer, and none of which mentions any problem of land maintenance or any problem of the small farmer. A sampling of quotations from some of these speeches, one made by a former Assistant Secretary Richard E. Bell, will give the gist in the manner of official agricultural thinking. Through agri-power, generates agri-dollars through agricultural exports. True agri-power is the capacity of less than 5% of America's population to feed itself, and the remaining 95% with enough food left over to meet market demands of other nations and still provide food assistance for poor people throughout the world. Agri-power should not be a political tool. Feeding people is too serious a matter to be left to political manipulation. Once again, growth in U.S. farm productivity is on the rise. We no longer have the acreage limitations which for so many years served to restrict grain and cotton production. The real measure of agricultural strength is productivity combined with processing and marketing efficiency. Years ago, farm operations were highly diversified, but today farmers are concentrating on fewer and much larger crop or livestock enterprises. Now, many one or two enterprise farms exist where there were formerly three or five enterprises. And with the spread of sophisticated machinery, farm sizes have expanded as their numbers have declined, stretching from an average 195 acres in the 1940s to about 390 in the 1970s. Specialization and growth are aided by the ready availability of purchased inputs and custom services. With additional income earned from exports, U.S. farmers are able to purchase more household appliances, farm equipment, building supplies, and other capital and consumer goods. Agri-dollars have gone a long way toward offsetting our petrodollar drain. Less than 5% of all grain moving between countries goes for food assistance. It is evident that U.S. agri-power is a major force in the world's exchange of goods and services. Agri-power is unquestionably an even greater force than petro-power in man's survival in the future. Man can and has survived without petroleum, but he cannot live without food. And that was the official line on agriculture during the Butts years. There's nothing in it that was not representative. The self-congratulation, the confusion of purpose, the complacency, the jargon, the sprains and ruptures of sense, the ignorance or ignoring of consequence, the social and economic prejudice ritualized in progressivist clichés, and nowhere that I have seen was the official line more complicated than this, more aware of costs or inequities or conflicts or problems. We would do well to examine these statements in more detail, for they are not just the political policies of ex-officials. They represent very well the prevalent assumptions of agricultural bureaucrats, academicians, and businessmen. Agripower, it will be noted, is not measured by the fertility or health of the soil, or the health, wisdom, thrift, or stewardship of the farming community. It is measured by its ability to produce a marketable surplus which generates agri-dollars. It is to be measured by productivity combined with processing and marketing efficiency. The income from this increased production, we are told, is spent by farmers not for soil maintenance or improvement, water conservation or erosion control, but for purchased inputs, household appliances, farm equipment, building supplies, and other capital and consumer goods. I do not mean that we should necessarily begrudge the farmer these purchases. I'm only noticing that Mr. Bell, the farmer, does not prosper to become a better farmer, but to become a bigger spender. The assistant secretary was applying to farming a standard of judgment that is economic, not agricultural. Farming is defined here purely to suit the purposes of a businessman. Mr. Bell makes the benign assertion that this agri-power feeds people, including the poor of the world, and it is therefore too important to be put to political use. But when this subject is reverted to, at the end of the speech, we find that U.S. agri-power is a major force in world trade, a force intended to offset the petro-power of other countries. And we have the assurance that, after all, less than 5% of all grain moving between countries goes for food assistance to the poor. And, of course, all this must be weighed against former Secretary Butt's avowal that food is a weapon. Next, we hear the routine self-congratulation of the department on the increase of productivity following the removal of production controls, the only agricultural problem acknowledged in any of these speeches. Our agricultural policy is now based on the principle of full production, an obscure notion that former Secretary Butts and his colleagues paraded before their audiences like the true cross. As businessmen and politicians, perhaps they did not know how strenuously agricultural production might be qualified by the restraints and disciplines of soil maintenance and conservation. Perhaps they did not know what full production means in present practice. Present technology, methods, and economic urgencies, having replaced those restraints and disciplines. In practice, however, full production means that on farm after farm, fence rows, windbreaks, and waterways have been plowed, steep slopes put under cultivation, and soil stewardship generally neglected. It means that production is being paid for not just with labor, money, and fuel, but with land. But the most remarkable and significant part of Mr. Bell's speech is the one in which he applauds the most degenerative, dangerous, costly, and socially disruptive achievements of American agriculture. One, economy of size, which means the gathering of farmland into the ownership of fewer and fewer people, not farmers necessarily, but an agribusiness elite, and the consequent dispossession of millions of small farmers and farm families. And two, specialization, which means the abandonment of the ancient, proven principle of agricultural diversity, agricultural stability through diversity, with its attendant principles of mixed husbandry of plants and animals and crop rotation. It is now, for the first time, deemed provident and wise to put all the eggs in one basket. The giveaway is in the curiously pleased-sounding statement that specialization and growth are aided by the ready availability of purchased inputs. This betrays, for one thing, how far we have abandoned the old ideal that the farm should aim at economic independence, That is, it should be far more productive than consumptive, more a source than a consumer of material goods. This old ideal sought to preserve the farmer on the farm. That was, of necessity, its first objective. But it also sought to keep the source of food independent of any but agricultural means, an aim that ought to recommend itself, it would seem, to a fairly ordinary intelligence. Its desirability becomes altogether clear when one considers that a farm, given the appropriate technology, the recovery and return of organic waste to the soil, an economy that is not exploitive, and a sufficient human workforce, can achieve a high measure of economic independence. None of this was clear to the intellectuals of the Department of Agriculture, and no doubt they were thereby saved a good deal of worry. For one of the purchased inputs on the ready availability of which our agriculture now absolutely depends is petroleum, for which we are not only dependent on non-agricultural sources, but on other nations. That we should have an agriculture based as much on petroleum as on the soil, that we need petroleum exactly as much as we need food, and must have it before we can eat, may seem absurd. It is absurd. It is nevertheless true, and it exposes the hollowness of Mr. Bell's contention that agri-power is unquestionably an even greater force than petro-power in man's survival in the future. Man can and has survived without petroleum, but he cannot live without food. The two powers are now clearly the same. That the two are not only interdependent, but competitive as well, suggests more forcibly than Mr. Butt's words that food is a weapon. And so, far from the concerns of kindly use that alone can assure a permanent agriculture and a permanent food supply, the Department of Agriculture is lost in the paper clouds of agribusiness, propagating statistical proofs of visibly ruinous agricultural practice. One can imagine the average American nodding over these expert reports and projections. Whether he is nodding because he agrees or because he is asleep does not matter. There is no difference. Thus, the estrangement of consumer and producer, their evolution from collaborators in food production to competitors in the food market, involves a process of oversimplification on both sides. The consumer withdraws from the problems of food production, hence becomes ignorant of them, and often scornful of them. The producer no longer sees himself as intermediary between people and the land, the people's representative on the land, and becomes interested only in production. The consumer eats worse and the producer farms worse, and in their estrangement, waste is institutionalized. Without regret, with less and less interest in the disciplines of thrift and conservation, with, in fact, the assumption that it is the way of the world, our present agricultural waste, topsoil, water, fossil fuel, and human energy, to name only the most noticeable things. Consumers participate innocently or ignorantly in all of these farm wastes and add to them wastes that are urban or consumptive in nature. Mainly all the materials and energy that go into unnecessary processing and packaging, as well as tons of organic matter, highly valuable and certainly in the long run necessary as fertilizer, that they flush down their drains or throw out as garbage. What this means for conservationists is that, as consumers, they may be using and abusing more land by proxy than they are conserving by the intervention of their organizations. We now have more people using the land, that is, living from it, and fewer thinking about it than ever before. We are eating thoughtlessly, as no other entire society has ever been able to do. We are eating, drawing out our lives out of our land thoughtlessly. If we study carefully the implications of that, we will see that the agricultural crisis is not merely a matter of supply and demand to be remedied by some change of government policy or some technological breakthrough. It is a crisis of culture.
And that really is what this program is working its way around to. The fact that so much of the destruction which is done to the earth is justified in one-dimensional economic terms, whether it's keeping one's job or earning money or providing jobs. It hides the consequences in the real world. And now we've just got time to touch base with David Graeber about honor money as slavery in ancient Greece.
Ancient Greece, honour and debt. The world of the Homeric epics is one dominated by heroic warriors who are disdainful of trade. In many ways, it's strikingly reminiscent of medieval Ireland. Money existed, but it was not used to buy anything. Important men lived their lives in pursuit of honour, which took material form in followers and treasure. Treasures were given as gifts, awarded as prizes, carried off as loot. This is no doubt how timi first came to mean both honour and price. In such a world, no one sensed any sort of contradiction between the two. All this was to change dramatically when commercial markets began to develop 200 years later. Greek coinage seemed to have been first used mainly to pay soldiers, as well as to pay fines and fees and payments made to and by the government. But by about 600 BC, just about every Greek city-state was producing its own coins as a mark of civic independence. It didn't take long, though, before coins were in common use in everyday transactions. By the 5th century, in Greek cities, the agora, the place of public debate and communal assembly, also doubled as a marketplace. One of the first effects of the arrival of the commercial economy was a series of debt crises of the sort long familiar from Mesopotamia and Israel. The poor, as Aristotle succinctly put it in his Constitution of the Athenians, together with their wives and children, were enslaved to the rich. Revolutionary factions emerged, demanding amnesties, and most Greek cities were at least for a while taken over by populist strongmen, swept into power partly by the demand for radical debt relief. The solution most cities ultimately found, however, was quite different than it had been in the Near East. Rather than institutionalize periodic amnesties, Greek cities tended to adopt legislation limiting or abolishing debt peonage altogether, and then, to forestall future crises, they would turn to a policy of expansion, shipping off the children of the poor to found military colonies overseas. Before long, the entire coast from Crimea to Marseille was dotted with Greek cities, which served in turn as conduits for a lively trade in slaves. The sudden abundance of chattel slaves, in turn, completely transformed the nature of Greek society. First and most famously, it allowed even citizens of modest means to take part in the political and cultural life of the city and have a genuine sense of citizenship. But this, in turn, drove the old aristocratic classes to develop more and more elaborate means of setting themselves off from what they considered the tawdriness and moral corruption of the new democratic state. When the curtain truly goes up on Greece in the 5th century, we find everybody arguing about money. For the aristocrats, who wrote most of the surviving texts, money was the embodiment of corruption. Aristocrats disdained the market. Ideally, a man of honour should be able to raise everything he needed on his own estates, and never have to handle cash at all. In practice, they knew this was impossible. Yet, at every point, they tried to set themselves apart from the values of ordinary citizens of the marketplace. To contrast the beautiful gold and silver beakers and tripods they gave one another at funerals and weddings with the vulgar hawking of sausages or charcoal, the dignity of the athletic contests for which they endlessly trained with commoners' vulgar gambling, the sophisticated and literate courtesans who attended to them at their drinking clubs, and the common prostitutes, slave girls housed in brothels near the agora, brothels often sponsored by the democratic police itself, as a service to the sexual needs of its male citizenry. In each case, they placed a world of gifts, generosity, and honour above sordid commercial exchange. This resulted in a slightly different play of push and pull than we saw in Mesopotamia. On the one hand, we see a culture of aristocratic protest against what they saw as the lowly commercial sensibilities of ordinary citizens. On the other hand, we see an almost schizophrenic reaction on the part of the ordinary citizens themselves, who simultaneously tried to limit or even ban aspects of aristocratic culture and to imitate aristocratic sensibilities. Pederasty is an excellent case in point here. On the one hand, man-boy love was seen as the quintessential aristocratic practice. It was the way, in fact, that young aristocrats would ordinarily become initiated into the privileges of high society. As a result, the democratic polis saw it as politically subversive and made sexual relations between male citizens illegal. At the same time, almost everyone began to practice it. The famous Greek obsession with male honour that still informs so much of the texture of daily life in rural communities in Greece harkens back not so much to Homeric honour, but to this aristocratic rebellion against the values of the marketplace, which everyone eventually began to make their own. The effects on women, though, were even more severe than they had been in the Middle East. Already by the age of Socrates, while a man's honour was increasingly tied to disdain for commerce and assertiveness in public life, a woman's honour had come to be defined in almost exclusively sexual terms as a matter of virginity, modesty, and chastity, to the extent that respectable women were expected to be shut up inside the household, and any woman who played a part in public life was considered for that reason a prostitute, or tantamount to one. The Assyrian habit of veiling was not widely adopted in the Middle East, but it was adopted in Greece, as much as it flies in the face of our stereotypes about the origins of Western freedoms. Women in democratic Athens, unlike those of Persia or Syria, were expected to wear veils when they ventured out in public. Money, then, had passed from a measure of honour to a measure of everything that honour was not. To suggest a man's honour could be bought with money became a terrible insult. This despite the fact that since men were often taken in war, or even by bandits or pirates and held for ransom, they often did go through dramas of bondage and redemption not unlike those experienced by so many Middle Eastern women. One particularly striking way of hammering it home, actually in this case almost literally, was by branding ransomed prisoners with the mark of their own currency, much as if today some imaginary foreign kidnapper, after having received the ransom money for an American victim, made a point of burning a dollar sign onto the victim's forehead before returning him. One question that isn't clear from all this is why? Why had money in particular become such a symbol of degradation?
And that question is going to go unanswered this week due to time. I hope we shall continue next week. The full text of the David Graeber Debt, the First 5,000 Years is available for download from this show's webpage, as is a recent interview that I gave to Tim Seniff of WNRW1 about who I am, how I grew up, what I'm doing with unwelcome guests, why I'm in Bangladesh, and a few other points. That I'll link in from my personal page, unwelcomeguests.net/Robin_Upton. This and all previous episodes are available for download, of course, whether through the text searchable index or the episode gallery. There's also a podcast link on the left-hand side. There's a mailing list, which has been very quiet lately, on altruist.org/unwelcome, if you're interested in contributing to the show or working with the collective. Our theme music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can. My guns and my saddle.